From the boardroom to the shop floor, good business runs on good governance. Join esteemed expert in governance, Dr. Nimrod Mbele, for the next hour as he takes us beyond governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's installment of Beyond Governance here at 101.9 High FM. My name is Nimrod Mbele, and it's always a privilege to be sharing this space and time with you as we continue our trajectory by interrogating ideas, policies, and leadership choices shaping our nation's future. And on that note, I just want to quickly reflect on tonight's conversation around issues which I think are of national importance. I want to weigh in a little bit on what we have seen in what happened in the country. Recent proceedings, for an example, around the Constitutional Court, wherein President has been asked that he's got a, or there's been demonstrated that President has a case to answer. If you might recall the Section 89 report, which the ANC at some point, used its majority in Parliament, to overshadow, and unfortunately that is coming to bite them. And for us, these are issues of public interest, particularly in the context of high unemployment. And we also picked up, from the president this week that he will not be resigning. He'll take the matter further. Of course, he's got every right to be exploring every legal avenue available to him. And besides, his predecessor has done it. So it is expected. It is expected that he will take it, he'll take it forward. But having said that, I think it's important for us to locate what happens this week in relation to the president's pronouncement, as well as the Concord ruling around Palapala. Because these are not isolated incidents, and it's always important for us not to lose sight of the bigger picture. The bigger picture tonight, which will frame our conversation with my guest, which I'll introduce in a second, is really about high unemployment rate that has risen to 32.7%, and using the narrow definition of unemployment. But when you look at the broader definition of unemployment, which include discouraged workers, and that percentage is sitting at 40%. And just on this quarter, we lost 300,000 jobs, and this elevates an unemployment rate to 8 million and counting, and across the country. And job losses, job losses were concentrated mainly based on the statistic released by Stats SA, they were mainly concentrated in construction, community service, and were as well as broader service sector. And for me, these issues are not just about are not easy, and they are deeper when you look at the structural economy, as it were. And these unemployment rates that are stubbornly shocking. And they have a face to it. The 40% that I alluded to, when you break down, poverty, unemployment disproportionately affect majority of black people. Yep. Poverty in South Africa has a black face, has a gender face, and that's a reality that we cannot avoid, So it is important, therefore, that when you look at all these issues, we're able to provide solutions that are meant to elevate or address the conundrum faced by, small businesses, faced by youth, faced by, elderly, and so on and so forth. It is within this intersection of governance and social distress that tonight's conversation is actually located. In my view, these are not isolated statistics. They're signal of a system that is under pressure, the system that has not been able over the past, God knows how many years, has not been able to address unemployment rate. Thanks, Greg. I beg your pardon. So in tonight's conversation, we reflect on high unemployment rate and the failure of small businesses, because anywhere else in the world, small businesses is the engine that can take most of vulnerable communities. I'm talking about youth. I'm talking about women out of poverty line. But anyway, before we get into the gist of this much anticipated conversation with my guest, which I will introduce shortly, let me take this opportunity to do what is expected of me. Thank you so much, Simpiwe, for organizing my guest here, Kagiso Zebediela, who will engage shortly. And of course, it would be amiss of me not to thank Craig, who's on a controller, pressing all the right buttons as we interface with commercials. Last but not least, I want to thank you, the listener, for making the show what it is. Meanwhile, I encourage everyone, as a norm, to weigh in, and I'm sure you've got lots of ideas, views, and my guest is the Bediela. Would be more than happy, for he's a seasoned entrepreneur, and he'd be more than happy, as the conversation unfolds, respond to whatever issues, queries, questions that you might have. Our WhatsApp line is 061-895-1019. And of course, your views, thoughts, insights, observations, whatever the case may be, are welcome via my X handle, which is @ Dr. Mbede. Without any waste of time, let me take this opportunity to welcome Kagiso Zebediela, and who's going to help us unpack this very complex and multi-layered challenge around how small businesses are navigating in the broader context of what I've already alluded to. Dr. Welcome to Beyond Governance. Thank you so much for coming through.
Sir, thank you for having me, and good evening to the listeners.
Absolutely. Who's Kagiso Zebediela?
I see the story really around who I am speaks to a young boy born in Soweto, Diep Kloof, 1989, so still fairly young. A love for food, I was the boy who was sitting in the kitchen with my mom, looking at her make my favorites, licking the pot of custard when it was being, after it was cooked. And I think that catapulted me into, this idea that food is one of those things that's a powerful tool to create relations between people and to bring people together. Fast forward, I'd been cooking for a couple of years. In varsity, I decide that actually I'm going to stop cooking for my friends for free and I'm going to enterprise. I've got two daughters right now, beautiful little girls, 7 and 5. They really keep me busy outside of my work. And I'm in consulting as a core because of some of the sort of mainstream challenges that I've come to see over time in my 15-year span in the business of food. So that's really who I am.
Great stuff. Well, there we go. And the man who's got passion for food is a family man, entrepreneur, running his own bed. Kagiso, when we started a conversation, I sort of frame the thinking around macro consideration, unemployment, poverty, in which disproportionately affect, as I've alluded to. What is your overall view of these issues, and how significant are they to you as an entrepreneur who's running an entity?
Yeah. Doc, I think you can't ignore what is going on, whether it's macro, economics, whether it's geopolitics. You have to understand that somehow it trickles down to your pocket. I think this speaks to the man on the couch. It speaks to the entrepreneur bustling in his, restaurant or in the street corner. Because ultimately, for anything to arrive to us as consumers, there's a journey that it takes. And if we look at what's going on with fuel as an instance, that is having a big impact on how goods are consumed, on how much they cost. And that is affecting everybody. It is not just, the guys at the top. It's not the Cecils and the engines. It's you who must receive product from the farm. They have to send it to a, processor. That processor needs to send it to the retailer. And that whole process is carried by diesel. And so if the price of diesel goes up, sure is enough, you are going to feel that knock-on effect downstream. So we can't ignore any of it, and we need to be consistently aware of what's going on around us in order to preempt, you know, action and what we can do to mitigate a really tough blast that everybody's taking right now.
Okay. Great stuff. I mean, we're going to take a break, but when you come back, I want us to, you know, I want you to take the listener into your journey, because you're operating in hospitality.
Yeah.
You obviously you've crafted a niche for your business in hospitality, which has its own pros and cons.
100%.
In the context of because there's obviously variation. There's small, big, businesses, and competition is quite stiff.
Yeah.
And everybody think they could just hop into hospitality because it's been defined as a low hanging fruit,
100%.
And yet the implications are completely different.
Yeah.
Let's explore those issues when you come back in a second.
This is Beyond Governance with Dr. Nimrod Mbele on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. My name is Nimrod Mbele. If you have just joined us, I'm having a conversation that just started. I'm in company of Kagiso Zebediela, who is an author, an entrepreneur, as well as the owner of an entity called Freedom Scale. We are locating our conversation in a context of high unemployment rate. Kagiso, before we took that break, he was about to give us a sense of, first and foremost, why hospitality? And I suppose for whoever just joined us, you took, this route comes from the love for food.
Yeah.
And you've just told us you used to see your mom cooking and this. Take us through how you end up in hospitality.
So essentially, if I take it back, I got into varsity. The first thing that happened, as a matter of fact, is that they gave me a name. So when you live on campus on res, you get initiated, and as such, you get a name. My name became Freedom. The guy who was in first year with me was called Long Walk. Apparently, both of us somehow said something about Mandela in our applications and somehow were called Long Walk to Freedom. So I got the Freedom end, which I think, when I look back, it's worked out a little bit better for me. Mm. I don't know if he's still using Long Walk. So fast forward, you know, I'm living in a six-man house with gentlemen who become my friends and essentially family, and I cook for them on a daily basis, right? In my last year of varsity studying biochemistry and psychology, with a little bit of time on my hands, I am making more meals than I am studying, okay? Everybody loves it. It becomes a cultural thing that, you know, we gather, we break bread. And eventually I'm like, you know what, with my little, you know, salary that I'm getting from, I used to be a therapist with autistic kids, I'm starting to feel stretched. So can you guys contribute, right? So that we can actually make this more of a family meal. And so fast forward from there, everyone's asking me, when are you cooking? Can you teach us how to make X, Y, Z? And eventually I'm like, actually, guys, you know what? I'm going to sell you this food because it's becoming more of a headache for me. So I might as well make something out of it. I take a bunch of stuff in the kitchen one evening in May 2012, and I write out the word kitchen. Mistakenly, I use an I instead of an E at the end. But, you know, that doesn't matter at this point. I stand on the table. I take a photo of this, and that becomes the logo of Freedom's Kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
I send it out to Twitter and I say, guys, on Sunday, we're going to be selling plates of food for 27 Rand. If you want to order, send me a DM. Sure as hell, we get 80 respondents and we are meant to cook 100 meals off a two-plate stove with those little ovens. I can tell you now that was a disaster. You know, having to make that much food from such a small, confined kitchen was really my first instance of understanding operations.
Mm.
A really great experience, I must say. But that's really where Freedom's Kitchen was born, right? And, you know, I take that and we moved from making meals for our friends on campus to going outside campus, to doing events for 400 people where food was centralized. That was the reason people were coming to our events, to experience my food. And I realized this was really something that I could make a living out of. And that's the decision I took. In 2012, when I finished my degree, I asked my grand to come on stage, you know, receive it with me, be glad, and then I gave her the bad news that I'm going to go cook for a living. Where she thought I was going to become a doctor. Of course, her understanding of biochemistry was limited. I pulled out some knives and I said, this is the direction that I'm going.
My goodness, that's so wonderful. I'm sure you've got lots of ideas and questions that you want to ask, you know, my guest, Kagiso Zebediela, who is the owner of Freedom Kitchen, as you've just heard. Our SMS line, it's 061-895-1095. I'm sure he's more than happy, you know, because this is a very heartwarming story, because a lot of you guys, and by the way, I've had the privilege of interviewing similar entrepreneurs who started off just like you,
yeah,
and who are making it, you know, to date. So yeah, there is a lot of, and I like the way you started and understanding the nitty-gritties of doing business. You started small.
Yeah.
The fact that you started with about 100, which was a bit of a disaster, to your point, I suppose you must have had a lot of your fellow students and colleagues who loved your cooking,
yeah,
because you wouldn't have had so many people subscribing to the meals. Could you just, what sort of meals did you prepare on the very first with a two-plate stove then and how you moved? Because I also want to get to a stage where you tell us, are you now specializing?
Sure.
But take us through the journey. 100%. You started with 100.
Yep.
Yeah.
Look, 100 was our first attempt. It took us the whole day on the Sunday to cook. Immaturely, we went out on Saturday. We went to go buy the stock items. We didn't prep anything.
Mm-hmm.
A very key concept in large-scale catering is preparation.
Mm-hmm.
They call it mise en place when we talk about kitchen jargon. Now, you have to understand that you can only do so many things at a time when you're cooking off such a small platform. So what it looked like was all the friends who hadn't ordered and used to regularly just come for lunch were called in to come and help on the Sunday. So you peel this, you cut that, so that we can actually get the food out. Our first sort of 50 meals went out at around, you know, lunchtime. And the last 50 came out later on in the evening, afternoon. People weren't particularly happy with the timing, however, very proud of the fact that we got something out. It had a smiley face on it and a lollipop to say thank you. And that was the beginning of something that I think became special over time. When I look back, you know, post 2012, I went into culinary school. I went in with the idea that I need to understand what the business of food is, who the key players in that space are, and how do I position myself as not a caterer, but someone who is a food solutions-driven company. And that was a big distinction for me because it also defined who the client would then become. Not a wedding, not a funeral, where I come from, which is very chaotic, but a corporate client who understands the value of a service. Because I have a big challenge with how small businesses, particular caterers, are treated in the townships, because there's a misunderstanding and this idea that it's just food. That statement alone holds quite a lot of weight because people clearly don't understand the operational needs that, you know, it takes to deliver food to 400 plus people if you look at funerals and the size of weddings that we have. Fast forward, you know, I get my first call from a friend who I was in varsity with, and I think this is so great because the relationships we built in varsity were so key and paramount really to my own successes. Calls me and says, hey, my company is looking for someone to run our canteen. Small bistro, they've got 300 odd people in the building and they're looking for an everyday service. I say, absolutely, I've never run a canteen in my life, but I am of the view that, you know, it's the opportunities that you don't take that leave you with regrets. You can always figure stuff out, right? Nothing that we're doing is new, and so the information sits somewhere out there. So I chase this canteen deal, I get it, and we start operating at the Cash Converters, you know, headquarters at the time. And, you know, that was a big eye-opener. One, the lady who took me in was so open with me, you know, in that she said, we are willing to pay X amount for you to manage this for us. And I was like, what? I didn't know that, you know, a management fee is a thing. And, you know, when I take it a year into that business, I meet a gentleman called, you know, Yapi. He hands me a piece of paper from one of the big contract caterers in the country. And on that piece of paper is essentially a blueprint of how contract catering is operated. And that opened my eyes for life. And I figured, you know, I couldn't look back. I acquired five sites. And eventually, because of solo, you know, entrepreneurship, I was burnt out. I was making, you know, some decisions that didn't make sense. The initial company we got into was bought over by another business who then expanded me quite quickly. And of course, I said yes, being, you know, young and ambitious. And that was really, you know, something that burnt, because we just did not have the capacity to run efficiently to make sure we can deliver the quality that's expected. And so eventually that kind of fell through. And as it fell through, I get a call from, you know, Mercedes-Benz in Menland. That was a really great time. However, a year after running that, Bidvest comes in and says, we're going to take facilities into our own hands. So cleaning is taken up, security is taken up by Bidvest, and eventually, you know, they're like, you know, we like what you're doing, but it's our business, so we're going to take this over as well. And so some really incredible lessons around protecting your business there, governing your business properly, and understanding what is going on around you in terms of making sure you're not stuck with one client. You know, we were in a situation, we had one client, it was amazing, but it was really a big risk in terms of how we're operating.
But here's something that I find quite remarkable. I mean, first and foremost, you started small, and secondly, you took whatever opportunities are given to you with both hands, and you started operating at the corporate level.
Yeah.
And while we're still there, you understood the granular details of managing a business, by way of managing a canteen, and you obviously moved from one side to five sides, and you know, you obviously diversified. I'm sure in your in your offering,
yeah,
and suddenly you now got to understand that. Once you operate in that particular space, competition becomes very stiff.
Yeah.
And somebody, big boys and girls, came over. And So take us through the lessons that you have learned, because that on its own is such a powerful building block for resilience.
Yeah.
That when you reflect on how you've been catapulted to where you are now, you have had so many good practical insights,
yeah,
that, you know, if you were given opportunity again, you do things differently.
100%.
What sort of advice would you give to up and coming entrepreneur who wants to focus in food solution? Because I like that food solution. It's not just, you know, catering.
Yeah.
It's food solution.
Yeah.
Because that's had a whole lot of implications around hygiene,
yes,
the cleanliness,
yes,
and all lot of stuff that which I'm assuming,
yep,
based on the fact that you grew that long or that fast, you must have had those kinds of standards,
sure,
widely knitted and widely tightened.
100%.
Take us through that for someone who's listening to the show now and listening to, I want to be Gakhi, sir.
I think, Doc, going to, you know, school was a really great help in how I started thinking about stuff, the world at large, formalizing what you're doing, right? Brand perception is a big deal in the world of hospitality. How you look as the head of the enterprise, how your business looks when it's delivered to people. And I'm talking the type of vehicle, the aprons that are on the people, the chef jackets, you know, are they wearing gloves, are they not? Those small nuances begin to differentiate you from someone who comes in and doesn't look as appetizing, for lack of a better word, right? And at a corporate level, it's all about formalizing, right? Mm-hmm. I remember sending an invoice through to SAB at the time, and it was a Word document. This was probably mid-2012, right? I'm still learning. I'm in the course trying to understand this world. I send them this invoice, and they return it to me, and they say to me, it doesn't have a date. It does not say tax invoice, and it also is in Word document. And I'm like, so what's the problem? I mean, you know, I've written invoice, I've written. So I had made the mistake of putting a VAT value when I was not a VAT vendor, right? So understanding the implications around that, but also the fact that anybody could change the values on this particular document along the chain, right? And that's obviously a governance issue for them as a big business. So the understanding that you have to present things formally is so key in maintaining those relationships. The same applies to being able to deliver a statement to a client who says, we've been doing business. Yes, we understand we haven't paid you. Could you please just send us a statement so we can see where you're sitting, where your account is with us? And you don't have one because you've been invoicing from Excel. So now you are panicking because how do I even put together a statement, right? And I'm making mention of these small nuanced issues because they've brought me to where I am today, right? You are excited as a young chef, as a young culinary, you know, enterprise individual. You want to have people taste your food. That's the goal, right? For them to say, this was great. We had a great time. What you're not doing is documenting recipes. And so what that begins to do is that you run into small challenges that you can't even explain, right? I have spent 500 Rand from a 1,000 Rand invoice. Now I'm having to pay for water. I'm having to pay for Tabo, who was helping me. And there's nothing left for me. How did that happen? I worked so hard, you know, we delivered a great product. And yet month end has come and I've got nothing to show for it. That's one piece. And we you know, we park it. And so over the years, what I've come to understand is that we don't get taught the business of food. We get taught that the cooking is what's key. But we forget that the engine is actually understanding the numbers.
Absolutely. And talking of the numbers, One big issue that confronts any business, any small businesses, whether, in fact, it doesn't really matter whether it's small, big, or medium, is cash flow.
That's it.
Okay?
That's it.
And from your end, how were you able to manage your cash flow, take into account all your inputs cost, whether it is your ingredients, whether it is taking care of the salaries, transportation, and all those issues which at the back of a promise to deliver, and you suddenly realize, my goodness, I'm actually short with X.
That's it.
You know, because I didn't properly do projections.
That's it.
And the stuff that I needed to acquire, it's not. From the cash flow point of view, what were the biggest lessons that you had to quickly, you know, manage, and what it means for up-and-coming entrepreneur who don't seem to understand that the food business, the food solution has, you need to understand the numbers.
That's it.
Very quickly.
Yeah. I was lucky that a life partner of mine at some point in my journey was very astute in business. She used to run books for a very big business. And so part of what she, you know, did and advised me was, one, let's put some money away for rainy days. Very big lesson there, right? Save it, don't touch it. Open a separate account for VAT, because you know what's going to happen. You're going to dip into that, and then you're not going to be able to pay VAT, and then the consequences are dire, right? So the other thing that I understood quite quickly was negotiation, right? I'm a small business. I don't have the pockets to absorb 30-day terms. I don't have, you know, the pockets to absorb 60-day terms. And if you really love and value what I'm, you know, able to deliver, then surely we can discuss better terms, right? So either 7, or you're going to give me a decent enough deposit to be able to do the job. And my benchmark was, you know, if you can give me 60, I can do the job. I'm happy to wait so long as I'm able to deliver to you without having to tap into, you know, money you've gotten as a deposit for something that's coming in the future, because that creates another level of challenges.
Amazing, amazing, amazing. Let's quickly take a break. When you come back, I want us to, again, on the around issues of the cash flow, you also spoke about brand equity.
Yeah.
And the standards associated, because ultimately, when you move from one to five store,
yeah,
you become a brand. As soon as you become a brand, there's the certain level of expectation, mm-hmm, associated with that kind of an organization.
Absolutely.
So when you come back, I want us to take us through how you manage the brand, because the brand is all about the reputation. It's 100%. All about the quality, the quality that you promise and the quality that you provide or stick to,
yeah,
when delivering the goodies to your clients.
Absolutely.
This is Beyond Governance with Dr. Nimrod Dembele on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. My name is Nimrod Dembele. For those who have just joined us, I'm in conversation with Lakhiso Zebediela, who is the founder of Freedom Kitchen. The man who specializes in cluttered dishes, and this is amazing. I should have asked you to bring some stuff so that I can, you know, I can taste, and I'm able to confirm the equity that you claim is offer. But anyway, that is a conversation for another day.
100%.
Be that as may. Before we took that break, Kagiso, you mentioned something that is so important. For you to become a brand, you had to go to school. You had to you went to culinary school, that gave you a sense of how you reposition your business moving forward. And we spoke about cash flow, and I think you've given us a bit of enough to go to bite, and some lessons for up and coming entrepreneur.
Yeah.
The other issue that I wanted us to talk about is brand. And how you manage your brand, because when you move from one to five, and it's easy to, you know, by the time you get to the fifth outlet, which means everybody's taking you seriously.
Yeah,
it's a moral booster. It's a confidence booster.
Absolutely.
That you do have what it takes to create an empire, and it's so important because. You know, you are as good as your last dish, so to speak. For those that are in consulting, you know, your next meal is not guaranteed, because your last assignment will determine how far you go.
100%.
And which means you cannot falter on quality. We cannot falter on any standard, because the 10% of your clients can give you 90%. Do you manage to maintain and keep the 10% of your clients based on brand and brand equity and how you projected yourself vis-a-vis the brand promise that you've made and that you successfully kept?
Sure. So, you know, I spoke earlier on when I spoke about how I started this business, right? Feet on the table, first wrong move from a hygiene perspective. You know, kitchen knives, towels, you know, sponges, etc., to write out this word kitchen. After about 5 years, I think, of operating, we then begin to transition the brand logo, right? Because this was kind of dull, not very clear, not so great as well for, you know, different types of documents and products. So you couldn't put it on a cup, you couldn't put it on a t-shirt, so it wasn't particularly clear. The network that I found myself, you know, surrounded by was made up of guys who are entrepreneurial in spirit as well. And so they were chiming in to say, you've got a really strong brand. We now need to reposition it from just an aesthetic perspective, because really hospitality is about aesthetic.
Absolutely.
People really care about how it looks, right? And that is both the danger of the entrepreneur and the customer, right? Is that they care too much about the aesthetic of what it is that they are doing. Nonetheless, we take this brand and we formulate it into now a circular shape. We use these forks and knives as part of the actual brand itself, and we rebrand the business. It's blue and red at the time, and it still speaks to a particular level of operation, right? If you think about colors and the psychology of colors, you also understand which layers of society they activate, right? So that's another point. Some 5 to 6 years after that, the brand changes from red and blue to black and gold. We don't do away with the red and blue because it still services a particular segment of the market. However, the black and gold now speaks to, you know, what we would take as luxurious, as more a more niche client.
More discerning.
You know, gold, you know, forks and knives are usually used in spaces where people really, you know, take themselves seriously. And so that transition from day one Freedom's Kitchen to, you know, 10, 15 years later is a completely different monster. How it moves is very different as well. So I make this example all the time when I speak to young people that I'm mentoring, to say, you have to understand that everyone in the value chain is watching what you're doing, mm-hmm. right? So when you arrive at a client's office, as an example, and you know that you haven't actually packed your things properly, and there's a likely chance that things may have spilled or shifted, or you're in a rush because you know this is what happens, park your car in such a way that when you open the boot, mm-hmm. it's not open to the doors mm-hmm. of the business mm-hmm. you're going to walk through. Because people coming in or out are looking inside that boot and thinking, is this what we're going to eat? Right? And that speaks to the car itself. Is it clean? Does it look presentable? You yourself, you've been, you know, and this is the case for a lot of entrepreneurs, you are the cook, you are also the one that presents, you must also sit in the boardrooms and negotiate. So, you know, you wear all these hats, but are you cognizant of that, right? There's nothing wrong with you being in your kitchen in an apron and cooking, but when you arrive at the client, you have to take that off. Because when I look at you as a service provider and see a servant, I treat you as such. But if I see you in a clean, you know, crisp jacket, I see you as a business person that I must engage. And that distinction has done a world of wonders for me personally, right? Because I can now all of a sudden pretend I wasn't flustered, I wasn't so busy, I've got this under control. And perception is the game.
But, you know, you nailed it, because you're talking about the mental makeup of entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Because you come across as a person who was amenable for criticism.
Yes.
If somebody tells you this is not right, which are, in my view, not only just in hospitality, generally,
in
most
business.
People don't take criticism very well. And there's also this an expectation that, beg your pardon, you should understand that I'm from the township. You should understand that I'm black. You should understand that I don't have money. You
no
should
one
understand.
Cares.
Nobody
no
cares.
One cares.
And in your business, because I've experienced that in so many businesses across different sectors, by the way, and I struggle, because that says to me the level of readiness is lacking, and whoever comes into the space needs to be mentored correctly, that it doesn't really matter, because you need to deliver.
Absolutely.
And you made a promise, and the fact that you couldn't make it, it's not your client's business. And how do you navigate that particular space? Because it's such an important thing to position your mind as an entrepreneur, that you are there to serve and you're there to deliver, irrespective.
Yeah. 100%, Doc, and I think that's such an important topic that you've just touched on. You know, there's a lot to be said around this, right? Service is hospitality. If you don't have a paradigm shift around what that looks like, you are going to struggle, because you're going to have a situation where you feel like you're too good for certain aspects of your business, and that's where it begins to suffer. If you aren't able to pick up the forks that have fallen on the floor, to go clean them quickly and bring them back, because they, you know, improve service, they improve efficiency and flow, because you're waiting for a waiter to come and do it who doesn't even notice it's happening, you're going to have a problem. So granular detail, but action.
Absolutely. And I want to come back, when you come back, because one big issue is around training of the staff and how you codify that via manuals, because I'm sure there are a lot of manuals
100%.
In hospitality, the standard operating
SOPs,
procedure.
Yep.
It's such an important issue, because from training staff to maintain a standard, but also curating consistencies in your menu, so that when I come, we know all the restaurants that we go around.
100%.
You know, when you go to when you're looking for Italian meals. Mm-hmm. You know that the food is consistent.
100%.
You know, and so on and so forth. I want us to come back to that part and say, how do you manage the, you know, documenting your stuff, because that is big ticket it's item around quality and around the food, how you document and create consistency so that today there's not too much salt, tomorrow is this and
that's
that and
it.
That. People come back to you for your scones. They come back because they know there's consistency.
Always.
Always. After the break.
This is Beyond Governance with Dr. Nimrod Mbele on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. It's amazing how time flies.
Yeah,
you're having fun. Okay. I mean, honestly, you know, I'm already in my mind thinking we need to come back because there's so much food for thought.
There is, there really
and
is.
And I'm personally learning from this particular conversation, and I'm sure listeners are equally fascinated by the level of your inputs, your insights on a very unique offering in culinary. I must be honest with you. I haven't had an opportunity to engage so many people who are in the food industry.
Sure.
So it's quite fascinating and yummy, yummy. Can
it's
I say
great.
That?
Great to be here and be the first.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Before we took that break, the issue that I wanted you us to take us through, which we've sort of reflected on, you know, during the ad, is that for you to be taken seriously by big businesses, because someone might buy into your business, and the person buys structure, buys systems, buys codified offerings, by way of putting things together. You've got policies that are clear. You've got your menus that are clear. You've got basically in your standard operating procedure.
Yep.
Take us through that, and how important is documenting those key elements that you can use as a lever to go into big businesses, to partner, or to get opportunities
and support. Doc, I talk about systems a lot. Mm. I talk about systems every day. Mm. I emphasize the importance of systemizing your business. And people think, oh no, it costs so much money. Where am I going to find someone to do it for me? And I'm like, you've got the picture all wrong.
Mm.
You are essentially the system when you're a solo entrepreneur. That's what you need to understand first, right? I'll take you to, you know, something very familiar to me. If I decided tomorrow I'm going to start a kota business, right? South African favorites, got some bread, chips, acha, and some pseudo meat. Where I'm operating from is usually a small one-room space, right? It's got a little window for people to access, you know, their food and to pay, all right? As a solo person running that sort of operation, there are certain things I do on arrival daily, right? That sounds to me like a system, right? The only difference is it documented anyway, right? So you walk into your business, you switch on the stove, you get the oil going, you switch on the gas, you get the grill going, you open the window, you know, you slice the bread, you slice the tomatoes, you really just get things ready for service, right? That is the process. Mm-hmm. That is the system, right? It's as basic as that. It doesn't have to be on a five-pager where nobody's going to ever read it, right? Those are very clear steps on what needs to be done for this thing to work. So that if you are sick one day and Thabo has to come in, he can just read and see what needs to happen.
And that goes consistency if things are not documented.
First and foremost, right? So if Thabo doesn't have something that is going to direct him, what does he do? He gets into the store,
he improvises, he opens
the window. He doesn't switch on the stove. He doesn't switch on the grill. The first customer appears, the oil is still cold. There, your process is starting to show you where the gaps are. Right? And systems are that simple. People want to complicate them. And I think, you know, that is our outlook because of how big business sets things up.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that your systems are your everyday activities within the business assigned to different individuals. And so as you grow as a solo entrepreneur, having documented the processes of when I answer a phone, I say, X, Y, Z. I then follow up with X and then Y. That is the process of taking on new clients. That's qualifying leads, right? And when you talk to big business, those are the key words that they'll be throwing around. What are your systems around qualifying leads? Mm-hmm. What is your SOP around production? And really, it's this is what we do. This is how we handle it. And so we don't have to complicate systems, number one. Right? I think you have to think about laterally to say, what am I doing on a day-to-day? Document that stuff because it's going to help you be able to delegate and one day work yourself out of the operations, because that's really what we want to do as business owners. I don't want to be making the quotas forever. I'd like to have 5 stores around, you know, my township that are all producing the same quality at the same consistency through and through. And I think the mind shift is what's missing. No one is thinking about it like that. It's more survivalist. And we know why. There are multiple and plethora of reasons why that is the case. And so the mind shift is so key in trying to achieve some of that, right? And so I built, you know, Freedom Scale on the back of this information. I walk into a client's office and they ask me about auditing their space. And what I do is walk around the space and look at what is happening. Is there any signage on the walls that tells people what to do, how to move? Is there clarifying signs of what you can and cannot do and where you can or cannot do it? But then I go a little bit deeper and I'm like, okay, now that we have ways in which we move, what are we cooking? Mm-hmm. Turns out there's no recipes. So you want to make a stew the way you'd love to. I make the stew the way I like to, but the customer is expecting your stew.
But here's the thing, you know, Kagiso, I just want to quickly wrap up because the stuff that you can codify, write, and document.
Yeah.
And earlier on, you spoke of negotiations,
yes.
Because which is a skill on its own.
100%.
And unless you are embedded in the business, the chances are you may not articulate yourself as you should.
100%.
What are sort of the challenges that you've experienced in negotiating? And someone is listening, because that's another big issue, because you could be a good chef, but you're not a communicating person.
100%.
And how do you balance the two?
I think it's you can't defend a business you don't understand. It really comes down to that. You can't defend numbers you don't know, right? If I know that I can't go below 3.50 per unit, I'm not going to do it because I know it's going to sacrifice my business. And so it's really that understanding that differentiates you from the next guy and being able to actually negotiate.
My goodness, this is amazing. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it here because we are out of time.
Yes.
But we have another appointment. There you are. You know, thank you so much for coming through and for giving us wonderful, you know, insights around culinary in the context of hospitality, which is amazing. So from now, where to?
We're building Freedom Scale. We're going into culinary schools. We are providing a tool that will live in the curriculum so as to allow anyone to turn their passion into a business.
Well, thank you so much. All the best. And maybe in our next encounter, you'll give us almost like a feedback.
Sure.
On how far you've gone. And we'll always be in contact with you, because I don't think we've done justice.
No.
There's so much that was not said that was supposed to be said.
100%.
But it is what it is. Thank you so much once
Thank
again
you for
gracing Beyond Governance with your presence. Well, there it is. We're going to have to leave it. It has been absolutely beautiful. We have had very interesting commentary from Kagiso Zebediela, who is the owner of Freedom Scale, an enterprise that focusing on food solution, you know, very yummy. That also is the very food solution. Well, thank you so much, Craig, and the controller, beloved listeners, for giving us your audience. And I hope we have delivered yet a sterling conversation. Let's do this again next time. Look after yourself. Shalom.